It's the cinematic event of the year. Critics are saying a stunning, breathtaking triumph of savings. It's 2-for-1 cinema tickets from Compare Market in cinemas all year.
That sounds like a great movie.
Sergey, it's no movie. It's 2-for-1 offer on cinema tickets.
Oh, yeah. I knew that.
Get 2-for-1 cinema tickets every Tuesday or Wednesday with Compare Market. Simples.
When you take out a qualifying product to Compare Market, one membership per year, participating cinemas, 2 standard tickets only, cheapest free. T's and C's apply.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Nadia Khan. I'm currently recovering from laryngitis, as you can hear my raspy, interesting voice. So no fresh episode this week, but I promise this rerun is worth your time. I'm bringing back a conversation that originally aired in August 2024, featuring Antonia Cerejido and Lorena Rios, two brilliant journalists whose insights on politics, identity, and storytelling still feel incredibly timely. Now, you'll hear a few references to the 2024 elections and candidates, which made sense back in August 2024. And honestly, looking back now from where we are, their reflections feel even more relevant. Like they saw things coming before the rest of us did, because the themes we explore here are still incredibly tiny. So without further ado, let's get right into it and be sure to tune in next week for a new Immigrantly episode. Hello and welcome to Immigrantly, where we passionately and holistically celebrate the immigrant identity. I am Sadia Khan. As we approach the 2024 presidential elections, we are already witnessing the rise of reductive narratives and rallying cries around the immigrant identity.
They're coming from places unknown and they're rough people, in many cases from jails, prisons, from mental institutions, insane asylums. You know, insane asylum, that's Silence of the Lambs stuff.
It's ironic and deeply troubling that a nation with over 70 million first and second generation immigrants continues to vilify and dehumanize them. Politicians on both sides of the aisle are adopting hardline stances on immigration, with alarming calls for mass deportations echoing through rallies and conventions.
And bad things are going to happen, and you're seeing it happen all the time. That's why, to keep our families safe, the Republican platform promises to launch the largest deportation operation in the history of our country. Even larger than that of President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Yet, there are very few stories that truly capture the humanity of the immigrant experience. As an immigrant, this fills me with anger. When and how will we learn to celebrate an identity so intrinsic to the very fabric of America? Today, we are addressing these issues and going one step further by exploring the often overlooked narratives of those who return to their homeland. I have two special guests with me, Antonia Cerejido and Lorena Rios, the brilliant minds behind the podcast Imperfect Paradise: Return to Mexico. It's the story of an undocumented immigrant, Daniel Zamora, who is sent back to his country of origin, Mexico. And from there, a beautiful story of grit, vulnerability, and strength unfolds.
In a lot of narratives about immigration, there is an underlying message that migrants come to the U.S. because life is better here, that it's more economically comfortable, more fulfilling, more free. But Daniel's story questions that assumption.
Antonia is an award-winning producer and journalist known for her work on NPR's Latino USA, where she has explored a wide range of topics from cultural identity to social justice issues. Lorena is an esteemed journalist whose work has appeared in The New York Times, The Guardian, and other major publications. I am so excited to talk to them about their personal journeys, the podcast, and the impact of immigration policies on individuals and communities. And oh, by the way, there is a dog barking in the background. I believe it was on Lorena's side. Just ignore it. We all love dogs, right? So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome. How are both of you doing?
Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Antonia, you're based in LA, and Lorena, you are in Mexico. Where in Mexico?
I'm in Monterrey, Mexico. That's northeast Mexico, very close to the border with Texas, about a three-hour drive from Laredo, Texas, or McAllen, Texas. If that helps as a reference.
So I was listening to Return to Mexico, and I was telling Antonia this before we started recording, that it's a great piece of journalism, but more than that, it's great storytelling. I was listening to it at the gym. I don't know why I did that, but I was so engrossed that I think it took me longer than it usually takes me at the gym because I wanted to finish the first two episodes. So talk to me about how the concept came about for both of you. And we can start with Lorena.
Yeah, well, I'm a freelance journalist. So I'm always looking for calls for pitches or, you know, whenever there's editors looking for certain stories. So I came across Antonia's call for pitches for Imperfect Paradise. She was looking for a very particular theme. And I felt that the story of Daniel Zamora, of his deportation, could fall into the theme of someone who defies, you know, preconceptions we have of certain issues like deportation in this case. And Daniel, who lives in Ciudad Juarez now for over a decade, also has a connection with LA, and that connection sort of made it all make sense to me that his story could fit into what Imperfect Paradise was looking for. And I pitched to Antonia and they liked it.
So just to clarify, Imperfect Paradise is the podcast, and then Return to Mexico is a story that is a subsection of that podcast, and it has three parts, right?
Yes, it's three parts and then like a fourth story that is a separate story, but is related to the theme. Imperfect Paradise is a show what we tell like mini series, like basically a new story a month. And it's stories out of California. So we tell sort of these like unconventional stories about cultural happenings and political issues within California with universal themes.
You said unconventional stories. How is Danielle's story unconventional?
Well, I think what's interesting, so Lorena and I actually met before my call for pitches through another sort of Latino storyteller incubation with NPR program. And I was very excited because Lorena herself is somebody who's dealt with the returnee experience. And for years, I worked at NPR's Latino USA. And we used to always talk about how every story was about ni de aquí ni de allá, which is like not from here, not from there. And what I think is so interesting about where we are right now is that like because of technology and because of the fluidity, especially between the US and Mexico, this ni de aquí ni de allá is like actually it's like from both places. And all the time there's this like intermixing. And I'd heard specifically of like a lot of people who came from a Mexican family, grew up in the US, and then were now back in Mexico. And obviously that can happen for a whole host of reasons. Daniel, I think, is the person who is an example of one in which the policies ended up being extremely cruel. And he had to be in both places because he was forced to, not because he wanted to. But we're also seeing a lot of people going back to Mexico voluntarily. And so I was very interested in sort of that cross-border experience that's like beyond just like crossing the border, but just like because of how technology is and how the economy is and how we are culturally, there's like this very intense exchange between the two cultures.
Antonia, you bring up such an important point. Going back, by choice or by force, right? And there is this clear dichotomy of why and how people go back and how their experiences may differ. So what are some of the differences that you see in terms of people who are forced to go back, like Danielle, or people who choose to go back, like Lorena? And Lorena, I would really like you to speak to your own experience as well as a returnee who chose to go back.
Danielle was forced to return to Mexico, and I chose to return. But I think what drove me to tell his story was just a personal connection to the experience of return. So I found a lot of common ground between the two, even though for me, I didn't have to go through the traumatic experience of being expelled from your life, from a country you call home, from the roots. I'm grateful that when I migrated to the US, I was fortunate that I could do it with documentation. I've been back about 5 years. He's been back over a decade. And I was fascinated by how he's very rooted to Ciudad Juarez. He's very happy, very satisfied with his life, even though there's still this wound of he's not able to return to the US and see the people he loves. So yes, there's differences, but I think the experience of return offers a lot of similarities. And there's also a diversity of experiences of Mexicans, particularly living in the US. And of course, that reflects if and when they come back. And there's just a lot to explore there. Danielle is one story and mine is also one story.
You came to the US when you were 16. You left, I believe, when you were around 28. How has that evolved your sense of belonging? How do you see yourself as Mexican now versus when you first came to the US?
For me, migration meant the sort of having caught ties or the roots with a place that grounds me. So I've been moving around for a while. And now that I'm in Mexico, I feel like there's nowhere to go. Like I'm quote unquote back home, but I still feel like there's other places to go. So that's my experience, what I'm battling with. And I come from a big family. We're 6 siblings and 3 of them are like full on American. They are literally American citizens, but also they've spent now probably over half of their lives living in the US. And I do notice like a cultural difference now between me and them. I know we're constantly changing, but when you add borders to that and cultural differences and languages, I think it also sort of shakes you to your core and makes you ask yourself like, well, how much of myself is my exterior and my surroundings, and how much is it me just, you know, going through life?
Antonia, you grew up in the US. You were born and raised in the US. So I'm sure your experiences are very different from Lorena's experiences, from my experiences. What got you interested in this concept of returnees? Why that particular demographic?
So my family's from Argentina and I did grow up in the US, but my father's side of my family had to escape Argentina during the Dirty War and relocated in Mexico City. So I've been going to Mexico City my whole life pretty regularly. And Mexico City has changed very drastically. Now it's like become like Gringolandia kind of, like there's so many people internationally who come to Mexico City. I thought that that was an interesting evolution of the conversation around immigration, is like we talk a lot about the migrant, but we don't talk a lot about what happens after deportation or after returning. And so I was very interested in hearing that side of the story. And then the other thing that I think is that was important to us as a team at Imperfect Paradise is that immigration is one of the most important issues in this election. And there is a very stark contrast between how the two candidates have talked about immigration. And I think that what often gets lost in these debates is like the actual experience of migrants. And I started working 10 years ago, and like my first beat was sort of the Dreamer movement. And to me, it is shocking how little the discourse has changed in 10 years. In fact, it's gone really in a direction that I think has been a lot worse for migrants. I think the tenor of where the left and the Democratic Party is compared to where they were 10 years ago is considerably to the right. It's important to remind people of the actual lived experience of migrants, because people forget. And I think the most dehumanizing thing I've seen in a long time here in the US was during the RNC, the people carrying the mass deportations now signs. When I saw that, I was like, they talk about migrants as these masses. They're just faceless, not at all rooted in reality. So I think we have to continuously, especially as journalists who do sort of like long form narrative storytelling, remind people of who we're talking about, putting a name and a face to communities that I think get so reduced very often on the political stage.
When I look at the Democrats or Republicans, I see hardline stances on both sides, right? I feel like even with Democrats, they are almost embarrassed to accept and normalize immigrant identity. It's like mm-hmm. they recognize the fact that immigration is one of their weaker points, and they try to downplay it by playing into this good versus bad immigrant dichotomy.
Yeah.
So how do you see it play out for Democrats and Republicans? And how has it changed in the last 10 years that you've been a journalist?
What is so surprising is to see how the Biden administration really, for instance, followed suit with the Trump administration when it comes to asylum. Asylum today is basically dead in the water, and it seems to not even be a political stance to try to keep it, which is very surprising to me. What we're seeing, especially with Mexican Americans in the U.S., is that now the largest number of Mexican Americans is third generation. They've gone quite far from the actual migrant experience. Mm. And their top issue is not actually immigration. It's probably the economy or other things. And I think that the Republicans have done a good job at presenting themselves as the party that is more in line with you getting ahead financially. You know, we're not concerned about keeping you in a quote unquote like victimization standpoint. We actually want you to like assimilate and get ahead in the United States. And I think that for a lot of third generation immigrants, that's been a really powerful message. And you see like Mexican Americans are going for Trump in this election based on anecdotal things far more than they were in the past. I think the Democrats actually have like a lot of work to do in speaking to Latino community specifically in their messaging. I think the thing is like the Democrats are just putting themselves like slightly to the left of the Republicans on migration.
Yeah, you're right.
Kamala is presenting all sorts of interesting dynamics when it comes to immigration, obviously, given the fact that she is the daughter of two immigrants. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I feel yet about it. I'm curious, Sadia, yeah, from your perspective, how you see her as a candidate.
You know, it goes back to that same good versus bad immigrant dynamic. And I think most of the time, the way it's calcified in American narrative or psyche is that good immigrants are those who work hard, they pay taxes, all that BS. But I think it's really centered around socioeconomic status of immigrants coming into the US, right?
Mm-hmm.
So immigrants who come for college, immigrants who come here for professional jobs, they are deemed as good immigrants. But then working class immigrants are treated as not wanted by the society. And I think that dichotomy exists very clearly. And it really pisses me off that as immigrants, we are just used as political pawns without really focusing on who we are and how our stories are so different and so diverse. Antonia, I'm also interested, Danielle's story, how does it change the idea of American dream for immigrants? How does it alter it? How does it shatter that notion of the American dream?
Well, I'm excited to hear what Lorena is going to say about this. But for me, I think one of the things that was so provocative about this series is that Daniel has a really wonderful life in Mexico. And I think it's so often that we talk about the U.S. being the ultimate goal. And the U.S., I mean, if they care about having like a highly educated, very like smart citizenship, like they messed up. Daniel took his U.S. education that he loved and that he worked so hard for, and he took it back to Mexico, and he's thriving. And so I think it shows that the policies are stupid. And also that, like, this idea of the U.S. being the ultimate goal, like, is kind of ridiculous. That aspect of the story I really loved. Lorena, I'm curious, yeah, how you think it complicates the American dream.
I think for me, it's still something that I ask myself, like, what really is the American dream? And why is it still so much part of our imaginary as people who are not from the U.S.? Because when reporting this story and talking through these things with the team, we did realize that the American dream might still be very real for people who are fleeing persecution or whose lives are in danger or who just really are looking for better economic opportunities and a better life for their families. And I don't feel in a position to tell them, you know, that's not real. Whatever lies ahead is not going to be as great, because I just don't know. And there are many challenges awaiting them in the U.S., especially if they are undocumented, especially with an immigration system that doesn't really quite work that well in the U.S. But I'm not ready to eliminate or completely tear down this idea of the American dream. But I do think now that I've returned to Mexico and that I've met other returnees and explored this through my work, that Mexico also offers opportunities, and that perhaps a lot of the times what prevents us from wanting to come back, if we do have the choice to do so, or the inkling, is our perceptions of our own home countries when they are not the U.S., when we're not this huge economic power, where the dollar is not one of the strongest currencies, when we don't have the wages that the U.S. offers. Of course, it feels like a downgrade, or it can feel like a downgrade. And I think that's something that Daniel discovered, even though the very painful separation from his relationships in the U.S. and the fact that he's forced out of the country, he rediscovered like a love for Mexican culture, an appreciation for his heritage. It was in the inverse. For me, when I migrated, the world opened up. And for Daniel, when he returned, the world opened up to him. Like, he's traveled to all these different countries. He's traveled to many cities in Mexico. So I think this idea of the American dream and the Mexican dream is very relative. And there are experiences of returnees where they are just not happy in Mexico, where they do not have access to opportunities that Daniel and I have, because they do not have a U.S. education. Maybe they didn't go to college, or the work experience to sort of relaunch their lives here. Maybe they just don't want to be in Mexico, and that's totally fine and really painful. I mean, I just can't, if it's hard for me to kind of make sense of my situation and I chose to come back, I can't imagine sort of really not wanting to be in a country that doesn't have resources for returnees. You know, we don't know exactly how communities welcome returnees or deportees back. So there's definitely many challenges as well in building a Mexican dream.
Can you discuss the social dynamics and community responses to returnees in Mexico? I mean, are they generally welcomed back, or do they face resistance?
There's a lot of research on returnees, both from Mexican scholars and scholars in the U.S. It's very diverse. You know, it's not the same thing whether you're returning to a big city or if you're returning to a small town. It's not the same whether you have a family network or a support system like friends, relatives, or if you come back alone. There's people who prefer to stay in border towns because maybe they have family just across the border, or they want to be close to the U.S. in some way. What we found by talking to scholars is that there is also stigma attached to return, especially if it's through deportation, because there's this notion that deportees are criminals and that they broke the law in the U.S. and that's why they were deported. And I mean, Mexicans, I don't want to speak for my whole culture, but I feel we can be a bit insensitive sometimes and not very aware of the relationship, like the very deep relationship we have with the US. So there's derogatory terms like calling someone a pocho if it's someone who, you know, is of Mexican descent and grew up in the US. That is changing. I think there's also people who are revindicating that term and reappropriating it. But at large, Mexican society just doesn't make sense of a Mexican who is very American or Americanized or, you know, who speaks better English than Spanish. I think that's something that a lot of Mexicans just can't accept. They can be a bit nasty about. So Daniel, from what he's told us, he didn't experience that, a rejection from his community in Ciudad Juárez. But Ciudad Juárez is a border town, and border towns are more accepting of this fusion of cultures. For me, since sort of my privilege and my background, I think I came back and inserted myself as someone who looks like never left. And that has its advantages, but also it's a bit isolating to not be able to connect with people through that place, which is one of the reasons why I connected with Daniel so well, because even though we have very different experiences, like there was this unspoken connection between us of having been immigrants in the US and perhaps having experienced similar things.
Antonia, I do want to talk a little bit about something that you said earlier about you seeing a lot of people going back to their countries of origin. And you've given example of a lot of Mexicans going back to Mexico. And I wonder if that's mostly happening for a certain generation. How do younger returnees differ from older ones? Is there a generational shift happening right now?
I don't know if there's a generational shift. I spoke to Mike Madrid a couple weeks ago, and he just wrote a book about the current Latino demographics in the US. And he says that like a lot of people are asking whether the Mexican Americans in the US right now are sort of like the Italians who came. We are seeing some interesting similarities, like a lot of Italians were like from JFK to Nixon, kind of. And then also it was like the time where like pizza was really popular and like Frank Sinatra was huge. And I feel like Mexican culture is like so deeply embedded in the US culture, and it has forever. But I do think that there was a huge migration post NAFTA. And so we're seeing a sort of different, very specific generation. But of course, what makes it different than the Italian Americans of before is the fact that there is this fluidity. And I also think in general, there is much more fluidity now. Like actually a good example is last weekend when it was the Copa America, I was with a bunch of girlfriends watching the game, and we were curious. We were like, can somebody play for one country during one tournament and then a different country during a different thing? And there's very strict rules around this, and they are changing. They're becoming more flexible because they're acknowledging that for a lot of people, they may have grown up in one country, but their parents are for one country. And I think that's such a good metaphor for what's happening, where you are just seeing a much more globalized world, where because of the frequency of flying and technology, like just people travel around much more and have much more like global identities. I mean, even the popularity of football or soccer in the US is like, Things are changing.
I mean, cricket is here. I'm a huge cricket fan. I grew up in Pakistan watching cricket. I mean, Pakistan was a British colony before 1947. So cricket is in my blood. Like cricket is something that I can watch nonstop.
Do you play?
I don't. I used to play as a kid, But I am obsessed. And it was so heartwarming to see cricket being played in the US.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. Things are changing. I guess in some ways they are changing for the better. How do you think that may impact US immigration policy?
I mean, I think you brought up a really good point earlier that so much of it has to do with class and privilege in terms of like how the policies are really disproportionately impact which communities. And so I think it's ironic that we're having such a globalized time at a time where like people are really enforcing borders. And I think talking about how like migrants are always ended used as a chip, it's like, yeah, I mean, undocumented people in the US can't vote. And so I think they're an extremely easy scapegoat. I think they're doing some of the most difficult jobs. One thing that on Imperfect Paradise, we did a series about this white woman in Oakland who accused a Latino couple of trying to kidnap her kids. And actually, it went to trial. And in that story, one of the things that we discovered is that that woman, who is white, had been following these videos online that had really riled her up to believe that people were trying to kidnap her kids.
Oh my gosh.
And there is a huge conspiracy amongst a lot of people in this country where that like there are people trying to kidnap children and they use a lot of imagery of like dark hands on little white kids. And the truth is that there is a lot of child trafficking, but it's not white kids. It's a lot of immigrant children who are brought to this country to work on farms, to work in manufacturing jobs. It's actually a huge problem. And it's never talked about that way because people don't want to talk about what it is that underpins so much of their comfortable lifestyle. But I think that that's the truth is that there is no incentive for people in power to give those people a political voice. Especially because it's so that exploitation allows for so much of what functions, not just in the US, but globally. And so I think we're just going to keep seeing that. I think that's one of the things that makes the immigrant movement so difficult is that it is a transitional experience. And so it's very hard to build a consistent movement when it is a status that is constantly changing. And so who applies in those categories shifts. And even the people who I was covering 10 years ago, they're not as involved actively in the immigrants' right movement as they were. And some of that is burnout, obviously. But the other thing is like, yeah, once you become naturalized, you are less incentivized to care.
You know, that's such an interesting point, because I would have thought once you become naturalized, you are more invested in what's happening in the US and you do want to have a more holistic and normalized narrative around immigrant identity. And it doesn't matter if it's undocumented immigrants or other forms of immigrants, because the narrative is the same across the board, right? If immigrants are vilified, then all immigrants are vilified, not just one group of immigrants. Yes, some may stand out, but the vilification or dehumanization is across the board. So for me, I feel like when I became naturalized citizen, I felt the stakes are much higher now, and I need to speak out and I need to be more vocal about what's not right. If you were to debunk one myth about immigrant identity in the US, what would that be?
I don't mean to go full existentialist, but what is an immigrant? There are a lot of ideas around that. And to me, honestly, it's not very clear anymore because, I mean, something that Antonia said earlier, the majority of Mexican Americans are third generation in the US. Like that to me is mind blowing because it does make me question what is the connection to these children of immigrants or grandchildren of immigrants with the countries of origin of their relatives. Like they are no longer immigrants. I would ask myself, what makes someone an immigrant? And to really call people to question the image that comes to their head when they hear the word immigrant.
I want to push back a little. For me, I feel like there's so much focus a lot of times on distancing oneself from the immigrant identity, right? Mm. I have friends in the US who would say things like, oh, we are naturalized citizens now and we are not immigrants anymore. And to me, it's like, no, but you are still immigrants. To me, the important thing is normalizing that identity or celebrating that identity. You are the OG risk takers. How cool is that? And there's nothing wrong with being an immigrant.
Mm.
That's where I guess, struggle when people are almost trying to say, oh, we are not immigrants anymore. But Antonia, I would love to hear your thoughts.
I do think Lorena, though, is like talking like more like galaxy brain. Like, what even makes an immigrant? Which is not to say that people should be proud of being immigrants, because I do think that that's one of the ugliest things we see, is that people are being forced to somehow feel ashamed for that identity. When I agree, like, one of the things that moves me so much is thinking about how my parents took a big risk to come here and did it, you know, from a sense of like passion. And did you see the movie Problemista with Julio Torres? That's a very interesting take on immigration.
They didn't want to sponsor me anymore. I'm actually from El Salvador.
Oh, El Salvador. Pupusas.
Yes.
And those nuns they killed in the 80s, yes.
Right. So now I'm looking for a new job.
Oh, you are?
That will maybe sponsor me.
Oh, well, I'm not sure I could offer anything formal, but maybe freelance, and then we could see.
The character is like, wants to be a toy designer. And there's so much like surreal joy in that film. And I think that something that is very cool about the US is that, yeah, it's a place where like people want to make projects. You know, when there's investment, when there's money, people get excited. And I think that that's like a huge reason my parents wanted to come. My mom was a dancer and my dad was an artist, and they just felt so much more free to create interesting different things than they did in Argentina. I don't know, a myth. What's coming to mind is I remember being very frustrated, and I went to Northwestern. The international students had to pay full tuition to come. It was a significantly wealthier subsect of the student population. And I remember I was in a journalism class. It was a multimedia journalism class. And a girl brought in a presentation, a white girl from like Illinois, about asking the international students how they felt about stereotypes. Like, they brought up like the Cinco de Mayo hat or this or that, the other. And then all of the like the wealthy international students were like, yeah, we don't care about this. We don't think it's a big issue. And they had been making fun of the like Mexican Americans who had been protesting how they were treated during Cinco de Mayo. And I have never been angrier in my life. I went and complained to the professor after, because I was like, this is just not even a comparable experience. Like, these are students who often come to Northwestern. They don't have as much privilege as most of the people who go to this school. They're being treated like crap. And now they're being told in a formal student setting that their opinion on what is racist doesn't matter because the people actually from the country aren't offended. Oh, I was so angry. I just think that people don't recognize that there is a huge difference between being an immigrant, especially of a certain privileged class, and then growing up in the US, being from a marginalized community, that it's a very different experience and you have to treat them differently. Like, we are all immigrants, and I would hope that that would make certain people be more understanding of others' experiences. But I think that those dynamics are really important to understand.
And you're absolutely right, especially for international students who come here to study and go back, or even decide to stay here, their experiences are so different until they become permanent residents or naturalized citizens, and then US is home, and then the dynamic really plays out very differently.
Yeah.
In the end, if you guys could define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Well, for me, the U.S. is familiar. I mean, I'm from Mexico, and not only Mexico, but northern Mexico. Like, I grew up with privilege, and that meant we would go shopping to Laredo, Texas, or McAllen, Texas. I'm from a city where wealthy people fly to Houston or San Antonio or beyond to go shopping. Many people here in Monterrey own houses in South Padre Island, and it's like their beach summer destination. So I grew up in a very Americanized environment before I even migrated to Texas. So for me, the U.S., culturally is very familiar.
And Antonia, for you?
I would say like a dying empire that persists.
I love it. That's so true. Oh my gosh. That will piss some people off, but it's so true. Where can people find Imperfect Paradise Return to Mexico?
On any podcasting platform or on las.com/imperfectparadise.
And where can people find both of you? Any social media handles that you want to share?
Yeah, people can follow me on Twitter at Antonia, A-N-T-O-N-I-A-C-E-R-E.
They can follow me on Twitter or X at Rios T. Lorena. So R-I-O-S-T Lorena, L-O-R-E-N-A.
Thank you so much, guys. This was wonderful.
Oh, this was great, Sadia. Thank you for having us. Love to be on the show.
This was so much fun. And you know what? It's true. The idea of migration, immigration is changing. People are returning home, people from different backgrounds. They are finding way back to their countries of origin and they are thriving there. Danielle's story started with something very traumatic and sad, but the continuation is so beautiful. I would really, really recommend all of you to listen to this story because it will challenge your ideas of what it means to go back, what it means to be deported. Just keep in mind, this is one story and we cannot generalize, but every story counts. This episode was produced by me, Sadia Khan, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Immigrantee's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another important conversation to share with all of you.